Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the tropical punch bowl that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing debates in the workplace, variable type, and the mystery of the vaguely named creative director. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Rhys Gorgol. Rhys is the principal and creative director of The Company You Keep, a branding and design practice based in Melbourne. Founded with the vision that working with like-minded people produces better results, The Company You Keep set out to keep good company and help create great companies in the process. Preferring to explore diversity rather than vogue, his work has seen him take his unique design philosophy to a breadth of weird and wonderful sectors and projects, providing a refreshing view to everyone from maternity bags to vegan chocolate. Rhys Witherspoon, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's so nice to have you here in person so that you can see how sweaty we are.
Yes.
Or rather, I am. I'm dying.
It's just a nice sheen.
Sheen is one word for it. It's, yeah, I'm glossy. Certainly glossy.
Oh, you're like satin. Let's like lean into paper.
I'm into it. Jeremy, how are you going?
I'm doing really good. You know, I'm not as sweaty.
That's good.
But still a bit sweaty.
I like that you're wearing a black shirt so that you kind of just seem like a floating head in amongst the, you know, the foam coverings of the walls.
That's part of my management technique.
I knew it.
It's all that style.
I think
me and Rhys both had the uniform on today.
Oh, geez, you
actually.
Do.
Yeah.
And you're actually blending in as well because you have the white door behind you.
Wow.
So, we're coordinated.
Okay, that's pretty good.
We absolutely do. Rhys, yeah, really excited to have you down because, I mean, this is a bit of how did we actually kind of hook up in the first place for this particular piece? What were we chatting about? We were chatting about something completely different.
An event space, I think.
Oh, yeah. The event that you were doing at the compound. What was that event again?
So a friend of mine, Megan Voss, and I put on a charity exhibition called Simple Gestures late last year. Yeah, it was really fun to do. It was something we did as like 20-year-olds, 10 years had gone past, and we thought we'd do it again. So yeah, put that on. Thanks for the space. It was amazing. Raised a bit of money for a good cause for the Alfred Hospital. So yeah.
And then Jeremy thought he'd rope you in for the podcast at the same time.
Two birds, one stone.
Exactly.
Well, I think we'll get stuck straight into it, Laura, with your link of the week. Tell us a bit about this from The Outline.
I am, yes, as you said, back with a piece from The Outline this week. It's written by Eliza Brooke, and it's her occupational investigation titled, "So Can Anyone Tell Me What a Creative Director Does? They Seem to Be Everywhere, But What Do They Actually Do?" Which, we can be honest, I think it's a valid question. Like, they're everywhere, and the role is vague. The title is vague. But stay with me. I know that it sounds a bit dumb because we are surrounded by creative directors in this industry, but I am really curious as to how this role changes across the sectors and I guess as well what similarities tie it together and how it differs from other senior level creative positions. So first, in typical Lara fashion, I want to read you guys the opener. Eliza begins, "Right now, more than 345,000 people are listed on LinkedIn as a creative director. Like many executive level positions, creative director is a title that spans industries and institutions. There are creative directors at aesthetics-oriented brands like Glossier, Goop, and Chanel, but also at Harvard Business School, Microsoft, and the White House. The position is so ubiquitous that it's been turned into an Oprah You Get a Car meme, in which she makes everyone in her audience a creative director. While I don't claim to understand a job I haven't done, the role of creative director is distinct in its vagueness. Its end goal is hazy at best. To wit, I couldn't walk into a veterinarian's office, pull on a pair of latex gloves and get to work, but I do understand that they're medical professionals who treat animals. A creative director, directs creatively." And she goes on from there. So she starts her investigation by doing some research into what the everyday person thinks a creative director does. And everyday person in this instance is her mum and a mate of hers who's studying cognitive neuroscience. And together they sort of cobble together this rough outline that creative directors are people who make high-level creative decisions for brands and institutions and shepherd those ideas forward into tangible things like logos, events, products, and advertisements. And sometimes they're doing the actual design work, but often that does fall to art directors and copywriters or an outside agency, the work of which a creative director would oversee. So she then talks to several people actually in a position to explain the creative director role. But I think, you know, unsurprisingly, the answers are still very broad and they're sort of hard to pack into any neat box of sorts. And what she encounters is that people use the term creative director with such frequency and to apply to such a wide variety of people and roles that there isn't really one clear understanding of what it definitely involves and what sort of professional level you need to be at to do it. At one point, she notes how every second guy on dating apps seems to call themselves a creative director, which like I can vouch for during my time. And there's, you know, enormous number of them in their mid to late 20s, which is pretty unusual for anyone with director in their title. And with the current landscape of the creative industries, more and more people are performing parts of this role to some degree, rather than under sort of the traditional hierarchies. And so it becomes even harder to nut out a solid definition of the role. So she continues, she's talking to various creative directors or those who work with them, and she builds this image of the creative director as a conductor between a client and a team of writers, photographers, graphic designers, whatever else. Someone who constantly has to be working on multiple levels, thinking about the big picture while figuring out how to break that vision down into deliverables like social media strategies, photo shoots, product packaging, etc., and how they have to know what's going on in the news and pop culture, but remain independent thinkers, you know, and they have to be really good at managing a team of creatives and sort of putting their ego aside in favor of giving others the space to develop their ideas. And one person she chats to says that people tend to actually really underestimate what creative directors do because they latch onto the idea that the job is purely about idea generating rather than one that really combines managing and constant pivoting and problem solving, and that these sort of false impressions of the job make being a creative director seem like the sort of dream gig for anyone with an inventive or creative streak, especially when you consider how much it can pay. I mean, I think all of us would have seen some of the salaries that come with creative director roles, and they typically come with some pretty lovely six-figure salaries depending on where you're working, of course. Now, all of this in mind, Reese, I really want to pick your brain. You are a creative director yourself, right?
Yes.
Yes. So let's start here. How do you define what you do?
First up, when I got this question, I freaked out because I'm like, I don't know how I define what I do.
So like, do your parents understand what you do?
No.
No?
No.
When taxi drivers ask?
No. They're always like, are you right? Do you need money? the idea of running your own business and how that can self-sustain in that way, they're like, I don't know what you're doing. How many people want pictures that you draw? I'm like, we don't draw pictures, Mum. But in terms of defining my day-to-day, when I sat down and actually looked at it and thought about it, it really is essentially a quasi role of many things. Mm. So essentially as a member of the creative team, so there's a team of creators that we sort of sit under or across, I play various roles depending on what's required from me. Whereas other people within that team may play a more specific role within that. So a designer or a senior designer is far more singular in that they're focused on the creative output that they're doing. My role can move from doing that, creating the actual work, through to guiding work, through to playing defense on ideas with account management, to getting more time for the creatives, to explaining ideas to the clients, to kind of doing a whole bunch of
I imagine
different
you're more
tasks.
Face-to-face with the clients than, say, some of the designers or art directors would be, or I guess it differs from agency to agency.
Yeah, in our agency, because it's so small and everyone's kind of fairly fluid, the designers and the account managers are client-facing, so they are directly in front of them throughout that whole period. The one way that I kind of reconciled it in my head, and I don't know why I have this reference, is like the mid-90s Chicago Bulls. And I think about it as like, and
course,
I've talked about this with two of the designers on my team who, again, love basketball as well, Lukey Brown and Michael Longton, in that we're kind of relating who we would be out of the mid-90s Chicago Bulls. Who's Jordan? Who's Rodman? Who's Horace Grant? Who's Scottie Pippen? And everyone's got their favorites.
Sam the bar really real low. Want to be Dennis Rodman.
real low. And I kind of, in equal parts, go, well, I'm Phil Jackson. I'm the coach.
Yep.
But I also kind of want to be Jordan. Yeah. And I also kind of want to be Rodman at times. I want to play all these different things. And I think essentially that is the definition of the creative director, is as you move through being a designer or a creative within the industry, you pick up more and more responsibilities.
Yes.
So you have the capacity to do a whole bunch of different things. But when you move into a creative director role, you need to understand when you should be doing something and when you shouldn't be doing something, and when you should be letting someone else to do it, and when you should be empowering them to grow in something or pushing them out of their comfort zone, and kind of having that ability to step back outside of the tactical weeds of generating the work to kind of, like the writer says, conducting, I suppose, the vision in a consistent way throughout that process.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, that makes perfect sense. One of the things I was really interested in, and I often, it can be confusing, for example, when I'm on my side as a Jackie Winter producer working with a team of creatives at an agency, and you've got people where sometimes it's hard to tell the hierarchies, and hierarchies can be really helpful, especially when you're getting things approved and you're wanting to know, like, who am I selling this to? Like, who am I trying to get a yes from? And I want to be super clear. My questioning here comes not with like disbelief or disrespect, but genuine curiosity for the way in which sort of different roles on the creative team can contribute to the success of projects, and how in an agency you sort of go about defining those roles and duties. And you touched on there like some of the differences between maybe a senior designer and a creative director, but how do those dynamics sort of actually play out in an agency between, like, maybe you've got a senior art director or brand manager, and then you've got your creative director, and how do you separate the duties between those people?
It's a very good question. We build teams around projects. So there'll be a lead designer who is really responsible for that project. Mm-hmm. And that isn't the creative director. That isn't the design director. That is essentially a senior or a midway designer. Mm-hmm. They will then have a support team around them. And mm-hmm. the creative director is one component of that support team. So mm-hmm. essentially it is the designer's responsibility to guide that project or to answer the brief. And it is the creative director's and the design director's responsibility to help guide them through that process mm-hmm. and contribute where necessary.
Interesting. I love that. Jeremy, what's your experience here?
I think it's a really interesting issue at the moment, especially when you look at the whole digital design and kind of UX industry. And like I do every kind of episode that we record, I'm always frequently looking for a meme that I saw like 3 weeks ago, like to try to actually kind of illustrate my point. And I think that, I mean, it's...
Do you think in memes?
I do think in memes. And I actually don't think that's going to be a very unusual
thing actually.
In the future. But, you know, especially when you look at kind of... the only one I found was kind of this duck meme, which won't make any sense when I kind of put it up here, but it will be in the podcast in our enhanced content. But, like, you know, the whole idea between UX and UI and, you know, design strategists and design thinkers and kind of who's doing what, I think there's a real mess at the moment in terms of, you know, what these job descriptions actually mean. And I think the whole thing with these celebrity creative directors makes it even more kind of problematic.
Well, that's something I wanted to touch about. So, like, just to explain to anyone listening, in a certain portion of the article, Eliza looks at the rise of these, as you say, celebrity creative directors. So where someone with sort of clout is asked to lend their special brand of creative flair to a project with varying degrees of responsibility and credit. So, for example, you've got like Alicia Keys was the creative director of BlackBerry at one point. Puma has anointed Rihanna the creative director of various women's collections over the years. Gwen Stefani was listed as a creative director for HP for a while. There are a million other examples. So, yeah, Jeremy, continue on. What do you think about this sort of collaboration?
Well, I think it's difficult because, yeah, we're trading off kind of this bygone kind of era where kind of these titles kind of did mean something. And I think, you know, we talk a lot about this. I don't want to get kind of too D&M here, but this whole idea of
you
have a shared reality where everyone kind of knows that the same things kind of mean different things. And I think even when you look at what a producer does, you know, we talked about it when we had Brendan on, who was a line producer and, you know, could be said as a producer, and you have someone that kind of is listed on movie titles as an executive producer. Does that mean that what we're doing as creative producers has anything to do with that, even though it's the same thing? So I think people want to kind of take things from other industries and try to kind of apply it onto theirs. And there's no, I wouldn't kind of condescend to the work that Lady Gaga or anyone is doing as kind of creative directors. Like, I think they are offering creative direction. However, I kind of think now that we've moved from this kind of single unified understanding to a more diverse understanding where one thing can have kind of many different meanings, this is why I think the whole idea of kind of process is so important. And that the educational role between any kind of client and creative, it has to be kind of established there in terms of, well, what this title actually means and what duties is going to be performed and how you kind of take people through that process of kind of a brief that's specific kind of to your industry and to your product. And I think that, yeah, a title might kind of help act as kind of shorthand for that, kind of in that relationship. But in terms of the greater big world, what that has to do, I don't really know. But I kind of think the whole idea of directing and being an art director or creative director can be, for me, very much kind of like being a director kind of on a movie at the same kind of same time. Even though they kind of perform different roles, I think for me, the idea of what kind of, it's the next best thing kind of to management in terms of you're the director of the whole thing, you're kind of orchestrating kind of all the pieces, and there's kind of something nice and kind of curatorial about that. And I kind of think for me, that's how I kind of express my kind of creative work now. And that's kind of what I did when I was working in design as an art director as well. And I kind of think that makes sense to kind of help put my job in perspective. But yeah, otherwise it is an interesting question to ask, and I'm glad it's kind of being posed, and it's something that I think is getting a lot of attention at the moment.
Rhys, I want to know, I mean, what do you think of these sorts of celebrity collaborations, going back to that for a moment? Like, how often are they actual legitimate partnerships where the celebrity is sort of actually taking on some of the typical duties of a CD, and how often is it just, I guess, a brand ambassadorship with a fancy name?
Yeah, it's kind of hard without being on the inside of these kind of relationships to know how deep the influence is. But I do find it interesting delving into that when you actually see that creative impact of that individual. And this is a very uncool reference, but I'm going to go with it anyway. Aviation Gin, which is bought in by Ryan Reynolds, aka Deadpool. He has gone about a marketing campaign on that gin company, which is really Ryan Reynolds. It's the extension of his identity. It feels like it is Deadpool in gin. Right. So you can see in that way that creative direction is actually coming through. It is a true kind of guardianship, whereas the others can be more of a...
But I guess you could as well, like, even the Deadpool character, although he portrays it, he's not the one who writes the lines that makes it feel Deadpool. He doesn't set the scenes that make it feel Deadpool. So it's like, is there someone else just, and he's still just playing the actor that, you know, like, is he still just playing the puppet where the other people are sort of putting all that actual direction in? I don't know.
Completely. And I think this is where this blurring of titles, especially within the creative set, is becoming more and more prevalent, in that, to that point, he may not have written the lines, but he is adding something to
it.
So
yeah,
in that way, is he in this, is the creative director less involved because the designer is actually pushing the pixels, or is the designer less involved because the illustrator has done the illustration, or is the idea less relevant because a typographer has created the font and you're pulling these things together? And so the web-like nature of connections of individuals collaborating together to create a singular output is kind of informing this pluralism of role, which then is kind of heightened by how the creative industry tends to like to be open to possibility and potential. So they don't want to close off things into a finite box of this is this. It can be this or this or this or this or this.
And I agree with that. And I think that's, I mean, lovely. In the one hand, it's sort of like, who cares what the title is when all of these things that you're saying are happening? I guess the only thing to sometimes, I guess, care what the title is that being the creative director often comes with other things, including power and salary and whatever else that are involved. And so then people do care about those titles, obviously, because being a designer versus being creative director, no matter how much like creative fulfillment you might get out of it, there are very real, tangible differences between being one or the other.
Totally. And more importantly, I think as well, is the clarity from the outside of the industry to understand who to talk to, when to talk to them, why to talk to them, how to talk to them, what you're actually getting.
Completely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I think it's a really valuable role, but I think it's a very kind of postmodern problem as well, in terms of when everyone kind of calls themselves a creative director. It's like, you know, especially when you deal with personal brands, you know, it's like you have an influencer, like, well, I'm the creative director of my personal brand. And people hear that, people, you know, hear like the author.
I mean,
highlights.
I am the creative director of my personal brand.
Yes, we all know that. That's why you pay yourself six figures, right? Like, but I think these things kind of ruffle people's feathers in some ways. You know, like the author says, yeah, I don't get what brand storytelling means, but like, I get it though. Like, I know it's kind of shorthand for kind of, you know, something else, but I kind of think it is kind of a reaction to these things kind of being thrown around kind of so much. And it's a tough thing to kind of grapple with, and I think it also, it can fundamentally change kind of an organization as well. Like, in terms of people will, if people have a reaction against that and trying to kind of carve out a different identity for themselves, especially I've seen this happen a lot in kind of design strategy, where it's like, okay, well, because the idea of a creative director isn't respected or isn't really valued by kind of clients, they're going to try to kind of get a title that might work a bit more in with the business world. And so they're going to have more legitimacy, and therefore, you know,
The language plays a big role.
Yeah, language plays a huge role. But that's the thing as well. You know, we've talked about this internally. It's like, okay, well, what is the difference between junior, mid-level and senior? You know, it's like, and how does that kind of like, well, it, that might mean one thing in one company and another thing in another company, but you have it on the CV and someone's interpreting in some way. Like, it's crazy. There's all this room for misinterpretation. And then on the flip side of that, you have people that have, you know, bullshit job titles. Like,
we
may or may not have a little screenshot folder.
Dream driver or whatever the we do have a secret folder screenshots.
We may or may not have a secret folder of screenshots. But I mean, and that's, you know, and that's kind of just like equally as, you know, I don't know. So it's like, I think job titles are important, but I think more important is kind of having deeper conversations about kind of what the roles do and what, you know, how you're kind of solving problems and the results that you're kind of giving. And different titles have different meanings in different contexts. But it's, I think it's an interesting thing to kind of see come up in this context. So I appreciate you bringing it to the table, Lara.
You are welcome.
We will move on from there. My link for the week comes from our professional development Slack, by a new Slack group called Barely Managing, which was recently founded by Libby D'Souza, a former Jackie Winter intern who is now a PM studio manager extraordinaire in her own right. She recently founded the Barely Managing community to tackle the lack of community groups / support out there for production / studio manager / account manager roles. So yeah, we'll give a link to that in the show notes and some really great work happening there. But yeah, Jess is on that Slack. She brought it to our Slack. So it's a bit of a Slack inception here. And this piece is from the Harvard Business Review. It's titled How to Debate Ideas Productively at Work, written by Shane Snow. And look, as with most business writing that we talk about, there's nothing mind-blowingly new here, but it's rather a good summation of some key foundational points that I think are always kind of good to revisit. And I think that's like a lot of my internet hygiene as well. Like, you know, I just kind of look at this, I hear the same thing over and over. But for me, that's kind of what I need sometimes. So, but look, yeah, most of all, I thought like there's some elements that could really apply to creative shops or design studios, even though it's couched in the more traditional kind of business publication slash narrative. But before we get stuck into it, I'll give a brief summary of the piece, which starts by Shane kind of outlining that what most leaders of large companies face is actually this culture of kind of arguing. But funnily enough, the failure that arises from this is not the kind of conflict itself, but the fear of this conflict. And he goes on to state that this is the same reason that if you look for signs that a romantic couple is about to split, not talking is a better leading indicator than fighting a lot. Now, look, I must admit this is something that I resonated with quite deeply, both on a personal and professional level, because I'm such a conflict avoidant person. The whole idea of being engaged in conflict makes my stomach turn. Yet, this is what we do, especially as producers, almost every day with our artists and clients when we're trying to wrangle the incredibly subjective nature of commercial art. Now, look, I know myself, I really need to improve on this. I was reading the other day in a Facebook community group. Oh my God, this made me die. So I love my Facebook community group as well, because they are just filled with some fucked up people. Anyway, but yeah. So
ours is just like, did anyone see that helicopter? What's that helicopter doing? Do you guys get those ones?
Yeah. Did anyone feel that earthquake? What fucking earthquake? And like posting planning notices and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing. But yeah, so somebody during the really hot day took someone's parking spot by accident, basically. Like they pulled in the other way while someone was waiting, and they got in this huge altercation. And then he came back and he found his car keys on all sides of it. And, you know,
so brutal.
Yeah, and like, yeah, half of the Facebook group is people looking for witnesses to stuff like that. But like, yeah, I like, you know, I don't want to get too deep here, but like I say this on every segment, but I think like I generally fear physical confrontation, like more than anything. And my fear of kind of business conflict, because I really always think someone's going to kind of punch me in the face. Like, I don't know why.
What are you doing in your life that is putting you in these situations?
This is my deep seated Jewish guilt. Anyway, I just think if anyone else is like me in a constant battle to try improve this aspect of their work, this has some good stuff kind of in there to look at. So for this piece, it's really about reframing the idea of conflict and moving towards more effective discourse, exchanging diverse ideas and debate, arguing honestly for and against the merits of those ideas by training people to adopt the right habits. So he then goes on to break things down to three specific areas that have their own set of bullet points, which he breaks down as keep it about facts, logic, and the topic at hand. Don't make it personal. Be intellectually humble. And then he further backs it up with more dot points. And the one that I kind of really like that I'll kind of quote here says, stay away from questions that cast judgment on people rather than ideas. Instead of questions like, how could you believe that? Or why can't you see? Pose what questions instead as what makes you feel that way? Or what has led that to your conclusion? And for me, this is one that resonated with me the most. But at the same time, I could also see in myself and other staff members how sheerly impossible this can be or seem at times when you're getting baited or slowly ensnared in conflict. It's like something in you. It's like that lizard brain just kind of rises up. And especially as a creative, so often your own values and personal sense of right or wrong can seemingly be under fire. And it's hard to kind of disconnect those things. So look, I want to open up this conversation a bit more. Reese, I want to first kind of get your perspective from the work that you do for TCYK. So look, of all the bullet points that the author pulled out here, are there any which you or your team employ regularly when kind of having discussions either internally or with clients?
There was two main ones that came through. The major one that I am not the best at, or always trying to be better, is the separation of the work and the individual. Mm. So as a creative, or as, you know, designers within a team that are coming up with something or a response, there's an essential attachment to that. It wasn't there and then I had a thought and now it is there. So there's an immediacy to them and their identity with that. So by removing the personal kind of connection between the idea or the work or the picture or the type choice or whatever happens to be and the individual, you can kind of then have an objective discussion about that.
Something constructive at least.
Yeah, totally. One thing that a friend and I had talked about doing is like literally the start of a meeting is like physically picking up the idea and putting it in the middle of the room so that there is this separation. It's super lame, but it does kind of work in terms of it isn't me, it isn't us, it is this thing here that we are talking about, which kind of really works quite well.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see how that could work.
Yeah.
Look, I know from my own experience as a designer, we're often vigorously defending our ideas. Sometimes it can feel like a wonderfully creative process and sometimes not so much. I also know it takes a really great process to try to weed out the room for the subjective. So you're really just kind of looking at what you're trying to kind of accomplish together. Can you perhaps discuss some of your own techniques that, you know, that was one that was really interesting. Is there anything else that you use to encourage productive debate on either side?
There's two things that we do. One is scaling the timeline. So I think the immediacy around creative work or response to brief inherently brings a lot of opinion that is quite singular. Whereas as soon as you kind of remove that out to how is this going to impact us in 5 years, 10 years, the attachment to the idea kind of dissipates, but also there's a new level of why that kind of comes up around the legacy or the impact of it. Is this a short-term goal? Is this a long-term goal? Is this a slow burn? Is this a quick burn? And then that helps to make more objective decisions around things for clients and internally. And then the other one is essentially just asking the question why. Just kind of like that little kid's voice of like, why, but why, but why, but why, which kind of opens up space for, or why not at that point. You always kind of get down to that end point.
Which it's so interesting because sometimes people just don't know why, you know, or it's like, you know, they, you know, they're like, it's like someone else has just told them to do things, especially when you deal with bigger organizations. It's just kind of, it just kind of cascades down these kind of list and demands and nobody kind of stops to kind of critically look at it. Laura, I want to open the same question to you. A big part of what we try to do here is establish a really good brief. We try to avoid debate, but in many cases, we can't foresee everything. Can you think of a specific instance at all where you were able to steer a potentially damaging conflict into a more productive dialogue?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky question to answer. I think, for example, Jeremy, like, and you might feel differently. Perhaps I'm actually the whole reason that you brought this topic up today, and I'm going to have a very stern talking to at the end of this. But no, I've always felt that, like, one of the reasons that you and I work so well together, and you and Bianca for that matter as well, is that usually healthy culture of debate and disagreement that we have that is such a sort of key part of our working relationship. We do see things quite differently sometimes. And when that's channeled into a productive discussion, that is, I think that is an enormous benefit to the company because you sort of cater for each other's blind spots and gain some of that cognitive diversity that this article and many studies do speak so highly of. That quote in there that was it, studies show that most mergers and acquisitions don't fail because of conflict. They fail from the organizational silence that stems from the fear of conflict. That one rang so true for me because I feel like I've seen and experienced that in various personal and professional situations. And it's not pretty, you know, it's that classic story of letting things sort of simmer beneath the lid for too long until it sort of finally boils over and it's too late and your past is all burnt at the bottom of the pot and there's nothing you can do. And as a producer, as you noted, Jeremy, like you can't really shy away from confrontation. It is a big part of our roles. And of course, because it's commercial and we have clients and we need to make great projects and we need to make money, you have to be very careful in how you go about those confrontations because these are long-term relationships, hopefully, and making enemies is not great business. And also because as an agent, you're representing not just yourself, but you're representing the artist and the company as a whole. And so you have to be quite careful in your dealings. And over the years, it has become a bit of a specialty of mine here at Jackie Winter to deal with, for example, like client conflict resolution when it comes up, largely because of the huge role that language plays in things like that, you know, in how someone receives and reacts to something. But there is quite a different dynamic in that sort of situation compared to conflict within your own team or personal circle. I think some of the necessary politeness and care can sort of drop off when you're dealing with people that you're super familiar with. And that can be dangerous. I know that sounds weird, like it sounds counterintuitive. Shouldn't you care more about the, it's not that you don't care, but it's like you sort of forget sometimes that the sort of forced politeness sometimes that you use to deal with a client is really necessary when you're having a discussion that's heated, and that can accidentally sort of drop off with more personal things. And I think, you know, they mention in the article that while diverse thinking and disagreements can be uncomfortable, they're more likely to lead partners or a team to make progress, innovate, come up with breakthrough solutions, and then sort of consensus and nice conversations in which people hold back what they think. And I definitely agree. I think, you know, I'm a big proponent of devil's advocate thinking for exactly this reason, but assuming you can do it in a polite and respectful way, of course. And Jeremy, you say that facing conflict is what you need to work on, whereas for me, I think it's about tempering that desire to tease out ideas by playing devil's advocate without being bullheaded and sort of mistakenly treating people in a way that is just sort of dismissive or rude. And I think, you know, it's like, it's both interesting and worrying how, depending on your personality and your investment in the topic being discussed and the power dynamics that are at play, how one party to a conversation might see things as a sort of healthy, productive debate, whilst the other might see it as a fight or an attack on them personally. And for someone like me, who can certainly get carried away with the conversation, it can be really tricky to navigate that and maintain that self-awareness and awareness of others. And I think, you know, as I said, when it's a client, you're so acutely aware of this, but when it's someone you know really well, again, as counterintuitive as it might seem, I think it can be easy to sort of fall into that trap of thinking that the same patience and niceties aren't required when it's probably even more so.
Oh, yeah. The personality side of things is, you know, you can't underscore that enough. I mean, it's so big. And I think I've seen so many situations where clients actually go against their own self-interest because of some, you
know, digging their heels in.
Yeah, because of other kind of elements at play. So while I agree that, when you're all kind of working together and you have an objective that you're kind of going to, sometimes clients don't want to hear your suggestions or expertise, even though they've hired you kind of for that expertise.
Completely.
Because it's actually kind of undermining their expertise kind of in that way to kind of hire you. So it's this weird kind of cycle.
It's weird though. And it is about learning how other people communicate. And again, we've talked about it so many times on the podcast, but being a producer, being in any sort of client facing or just people facing role, that so much of it is about learning how people communicate and trying to sort of mirror or reflect that in a way that is productive, you know? But I think in terms of examples you asked before, in terms of examples when it's worked for me, I thought of many, but nothing that I could talk explicitly about on the podcast. But I think it really does come down to the common sense stuff, which, I mean, despite it being common sense, I agree with you. It's really good to refresh, to reread this stuff over and over, because it's hard to, as much as it's common sense, it's hard to actually actively do it. So like making sure you're actively listening to the person, really hearing what their problem is, even if you don't agree with it, and acknowledging what they're feeling, and then helping them to feel that you are on their team and have that same overarching goal, and finding a way to work with that, to come to a solution that you're both happy with, or at least that you can both sort of respect and understand. And I think, you know, I've mentioned this before, but some of my favorite clients are actually the ones that I have had some pretty tough conversations with, but sort of through that I've developed this sort of huge respect for them because of the way that we handled it together, and that we were always able to keep the sort of business complexity separate to our personal feelings and behaviors towards one another. And I think having those experiences with someone not only brings about better diversity of ideas, of course, but can also make your relationship a lot stronger once you realize that you're both free to sort of voice your opinions without this fear of retribution. I think that's a really healthy thing.
Yeah, that's why I love the whole kind of, you know, relationship metaphor there, because
totally.
But that's why I think it's so much harder interpersonally, because the stakes are so much higher.
Completely.
There. And that's why it's a great thing if you can kind of take those kind of similar concepts and execute them in business. That's why I love kind of articles like this, or reading kind of things like this that are from kind of other industries, because I think working within a business, it's a safe way to do that. However, I mean, that's a totally different perspective from me, like as a manager. It's my business. I know whatever I can say, like I'll live or die with it. But I think employees, it might be a bit more difficult, because they feel it's like, yeah, if your job is on the line, your relationship is on the line, you might want to kind of be in that safer area.
But I also, as I said before, like I always think about it. Like I think in a good and bad way, it weighs on, I guess, agents, in that you are representing the artist and you don't want what you do to sort of negatively affect their career or their reputation in any way. And so it's a big responsibility to represent someone in sort of formal negotiations and informal, like, you know, just the sort of banter with the client. You don't want any of that to come back on that person in a negative way. Everything we do is supposed to benefit the artist, not negatively sort of impact them. I think one, I wanted to mention that all of the suggestions in this article are great things to keep in mind, but the one that really stood out to me was the one about being intellectually humble. I think I really respect people who can do this, because I think at some stage in their lives, everybody has trouble with this if the argument is something that means a lot to them. I think even with the very best intentions, it can be sometimes really hard to separate yourself enough from your opinions to actually accept that you might be wrong or that there might be a better way. You talked about sort of clients just digging their heels in for the sake of it, but I get it. Like, I think we all do it at times. The article points out that for a debate to be truly productive, participants need to be willing to respect every viewpoint and change their minds when necessary. And that sounds obvious, but, and a bit sort of kumbaya, but like, it's so true and actually hard to do in practice. And, you know, people who practice intellectual humility, they say they don't take things personally. They listen to and respect every person and their viewpoint, even if they disagree. They're curious and they know that even bad ideas can be useful because they can help us find new and better ideas. That's a hard one for me. And most importantly, they admit when they realize that they're wrong, and they cheerfully concede when others have good points. And I think all of those rules are so incredibly key to allowing for a space for healthy, respectful debate that leads to new ideas and connections that wouldn't have come without it.
Interesting. Yeah, that humbleness is a great point as well. And we've talked about, you know, one of the best qualities a producer can have here is asking questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great as well, because like, yeah, it means you're not going to kind of trying to be solving something that you can't do, but it also kind of gives a really great opportunity for to be educated from a client as well. Sometimes that can backfire in kind of some ways, depending on kind of what it is. But Reese, before we close out this topic, I'm just kind of curious as well, like how do you, you know, when you're talking to clients, especially, how do you kind of differentiate between when, or do you differentiate at all between like when a designer is kind of talking about their own work or when an account manager or a producer kind of is taking that work and kind of repackaging and presenting it there? Is there a difference in terms of how you kind of approach language or presentation styles or kind of anything like that? Or does that come into different play at different parts of the process?
So designers are always representing their ideas within meetings and client-facing meetings with clients, partners, suppliers, and things like that. And the whole project team is there. So account managers, creative director, or design director, or digital director is there as well. But when we're talking about what we have done, the collective we is always used and every voice is kind of heard. So there won't be any presentation or meeting where it will be the Don Draper moment where someone gets up and flicks over a board and it's the amazing idea of the individual person. It is the collective we that you have engaged to respond to this brief. And as a group, this is what we think. But individually, there's still voices that can kind of come across that for dialogue when you're coming together as clients and suppliers in the same room at that point.
I love that idea. Yeah. I mean, because it also goes back to kind of the first link that we're talking about in terms of how language plays such an important part in things. And it's like, yeah, whoever's in the room and presenting something, depending on their title, that might be.
But then things like that, like language decisions like that, the culture of a company would then have sort of trickle down effects of how people feel in the company and how they feel respected and regarded. And I think that's a really positive thing. You know, those sorts of things have impact beyond that immediate meeting.
Yeah, really great article. Some great points to kind of consider there. We'll put all that stuff in our show notes while Lara continues to sweat it out and move
on from
there. I am
losing kilos by the second. Holy fuck. I'm dying. I don't know what's happened today.
Our final link of the week, as always, comes from our special guest. Before we get stuck in, something I like to ask everyone every week. Reese, what's your internet hygiene like? Where do you get your links and reading from online?
My internet hygiene is pretty lackluster, to be honest. I'm not really on any social media channel, so I'm off Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all those
Good
sorts of
you.
Things.
Very on trend. But you were doing it for a while, though, so like, you know, you're ahead of the curve.
Yeah, totally.
You're an influencer, you could say.
Definitely not the laggard at the other end. But things like Harvard Business Review, so reading a lot of business kind of oriented things, I'm quite interested in because I run a business, so that sort of stuff fuels that sort of ideas. And then it's nice that as a graphic design journal, it does have a lot of diversity in terms of what they got going on. There's a whole bunch of other different specific design blogs and things like that. There's one called Northeast, which is a Japanese kind of one that does interviews and things like that, which is pretty good. But really, this is a bit of a tangent, but my internet hygiene or a lot of the inputs comes from a thing that we do called Brown's Books, or Brown's Bootlegs, whereby Luke Brown every Friday will take a book that sits on the bookshelf and photocopy out a chapter or something of it and disseminate it to the team, and everyone will read it and then kind of talk about it. So rather than those books being totems that just sit up on the shelf, people are actually reading the articles. So that becomes interesting because it's picked at random. So there's a lot of like diverse inputs that kind of come through.
Cool. I'm into that idea.
And for this week, you did pick something from It's Nice That actually. And yeah, something that's really interesting that we've kind of touched on before in our typographic discussion. So why don't you tell us a bit more about this?
So Dynamo, which is a Swiss-based design foundry, a collective of different type designers, have essentially done an interview on It's Nice That, whereby they're releasing a couple of new design tools for the typographic community. The main things that they're doing there are sitting around variable typography, which is essentially a relatively new format of typography. It existed in the 90s. But now it's kind of coming through into fruition because technology is facilitating it more. And they've released a tool called Darkroom, which is a testing ground for variable type designers to put their working files through the motions. So this open source kind of tool that allows the whole industry to kind of get involved to essentially produce better outcomes. And then the other one, which I forget this specific quote of how they kind of pull it out, but it's like the Netflix of variable typography. It's called Dynamo Pipeline, and it's a way for them to kind of showcase what they're currently working on, which inherently I find interesting within other design studios, how they find formats for that. I know UP, Paul, Fuog, and those guys do a really interesting thing where they screen capture, you know, their screens at a certain point in the day and they share that sort of stuff. The behind the scenes sort of stuff of that is really kind of interesting. And so the pipeline component is essentially a way that they can publish in progress kind of type designs.
Awesome.
Cool. I guess I want to just quickly, before we duck into it, for anyone who isn't totally across what a variable font is, I want to give a very layman's definition. It's a font that sort of encapsulates the entire font family, not just one style or instance. So instead of having like specific weights that have been set by that type designer, for example, like light 300, regular 400, bold 600, the font has those weights plus any weights included in that range. So for example, any number between 300 and 600 could be used, and whoever sort of typesetting or the designer using that font can then sort of adjust as needed on a sort of sliding scale. And many of these variable fonts play with more than just the weight. Of course, they might play with the width, the tracking, the line height, etc. So this sort of brings a whole new dimension when it comes to tweaking the details of a design.
And it's not, I mean, it has really old roots. And so I don't know if I'm showing my age here, but in 1992, Adobe released multiple master file font formats, which was kind of a bit of an earlier, more primitive idea of kind of this tech.
Jeremy.
Yes.
I was in the womb.
You were in that's is that the name of a club.
Yeah. Sick 90s club I used to go to.
Nice. Sure. But Reese, why did this call out to you? Like, you know, what did you find really interesting? How is it relevant to your practice?
The thing I found interesting about it was more the open source nature of the tool that they put out there. So it wasn't that this was this hoarding of information for themselves that could have given them a competitive advantage. There was this open source mentality that if we release this tool out to the whole industry, you know, all ships, what is it, float with the rising tide?
Rising tide raise all boats.
There you go. Far more like eloquent. The quality of the whole industry will increase because of shared access to this kind of tool. So that became quite interesting to me.
Yeah, we've talked a couple of times about various sort of, whether it's design agencies or just companies in general, sort of releasing open source, whether it's actual software or, I don't know, just sort of concepts or whatever. And it's something that's always really interested us as people who kind of do try to work to make a whole industry thrive. But at the same time, it's a really great marketing sort of thing on their behalf, which is not, I mean that with all credit, not, you know, it's not a negative thing at all. People need incentive to be able to do open source stuff because it takes a shitload of time and, you know, and it's a beautiful piece of marketing for them and it's a glorious way to display their work.
I'm just wondering the actual kind of practical application, because like that's kind of something that I found really difficult to kind of understand. I think I'm interested to see how this kind of gets applied for actual kind of type foundries from a financial perspective. If you only are kind of providing this one piece of software, or kind of these one weight, and that could be infinitely variable, that kind of effectively cuts down how I think a lot of larger foundries kind of make their money by kind of licensing lots of different weights. But also I kind of think, yeah, I mean, it's something that kind of looks really cool, and I've experimented with it. There was one of the earliest versions of a variable font was a font called Beowulf, which was put out by kind of Font Shop. Are you guys familiar with Beowulf at all? When we talk about fonts, if you want to get technical, like they are actually pieces of software, and basically, and this was the first time that someone kind of took and kind of hacked apart PostScript language at the time. Therefore, every time someone set Beowulf in a piece of print design, it would actually, the points would actually move and you would get a completely randomized version of the typeface every time it printed. Eventually kind of software evolved and kind of shut that down so you couldn't actually do it, but it was actually one of the first typefaces that made it into the Museum of Modern Art when they acquired kind of typefaces for the first time. So yeah, this kind of whole idea is really interesting from a formal perspective, but how it actually kind of puts into practice, I find it so overwhelming. There is actually, I put on my graphic design shoes the other month actually to help a friend out with something and got this typeface by Peter Bielak called Wind, I think, which was basically, it was a kind of solid typeface in the middle that had kind of like, it looked like hair was kind of coming out of it. And you basically, in OpenType, you could adjust like natively within the dialogue box in InDesign, like, okay, how much wind is blowing? Where is it kind of blowing from? And do these amazing things. And you look at stuff like, you know, design studios like Dia, for example, and how they're using kinetic typography. And a lot of these examples showing off the features of dynamic typeface are always in motion as well. It's like, ooh, I got a slider. I'm going thin to narrow. Look at it. It's crazy. And it works really well in motion. And because type is being in motion a lot more, like I can see there's some interesting effects there. But I don't know, for me as a designer, when I have more options, I get so much vastly overwhelmed by those kind of things. I don't know if that's just kind of my age thing as well. But I'm curious, Reese, like from your perspective, like, you know, I kind of look at the output from your studio as being kind of traditional in kind of some ways. Like, you know, you're really kind of good at using these kind of these, I guess, design kind of principles and solid foundations and kind of putting a little kind of twist on them in kind of some ways and developing your own voice. How does all the variation that is now going to be available, like, how do you kind of see it actually kind of affecting your practice and using these typefaces?
It's a really interesting question, because I think at the moment it's really a novelty in terms of the practical applications of it, because it is so inherently dynamic. It requires a dynamic interface to showcase whatever it's going to kind of do. But if you move away from the inherent kind of visual element of it, or the bells and whistles kind of component of it, the other part that's really interesting is that it puts the constraints within your hands. So rather than the constraint being from the type designer of this is how heavy bold is, and this is how heavy regular is, and if you want something in between that, you can't have that. Even when you're setting like print type, like a book, now you can, through a variable typeface, you can control that line weight or that width within very, very minute increments. So all of a sudden, that variable is in your hands. So one thing as a designer that you're always looking at is different to an artist is you're responding to brief. So you're responding to parameters. But inherently, when you're using these base elements like color or like form or composition or typography, if you have more fidelity in those parameters specifically, it allows you to pick a certain typeface. It may be a variable typeface because the inherent qualities of that typeface are right for the job, but then incrementally control that nuance regardless of the output.
It's so interesting to hear you say that as well, because I think that can be a very positive thing and it can also be kind of a negative. Like, you linked us to a great article on the Pengram blog, which we'll share in our newsletter as well, of course. And they raised something that I found sort of interesting, and it's that, but kind of, the flip side of it. They sort of mentioned that whilst the idea behind the technology is great, they are wary of people creating these kind of Swiss Army knife sort of type funds that can be potentially do everything okay but nothing great, and sort of the risk in variable fonts becoming something where everything is a variable and you can create any kind of typeface with one, which kind of defeats the purpose of someone having sort of designed the typeface in the first place. And fonts might end up not having these sort of clear personalities, leaving the task of creating typography that works to a designer rather than to the typographer. And it also, I guess, maybe in the hands of someone who knows what they're doing is great, and in the hands of just any old designer might not be a good thing. I think there's a reason why you have people who study type for however long and spend ages designing this one set of characters to look a certain way. And then for people to just be able to kind of mess with that seems to defeat the purpose of having licensed that in the first place. I don't know. There's two sides, I think.
Well, that's the most interesting thing about this technology, that I think if you really look into it, that's the, if it's put together by someone who's a really trained typographer and they do it correctly, that's the whole thing. It's like it maintains the integrity of their vision, like throughout those.
And I guess that's
steps.
One of the points of the font gauntlet thing that Dynamo have released, is that idea of being able to see it's really hard to explain without people being able to look at it. So I recommend people definitely go click these links, but to see the characters transform, you know, from one end of the spectrum to their other end of the spectrum, to make sure that they are transforming evenly and as you sort of intended, obviously helps people to create better fonts. But I mean, as you said, Jess, one of the producers here in our office, she linked us to this the other day, and just to the darkroom site. And whilst it's like super cool, I'm admittedly like not that much of a type nerd. So I sort of like, I played with it for like 10 seconds and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't really know the significance of it at all. So it has been really cool reading and hearing about it from people who actually know what the hell they're doing, like you.
And the thing with the darkroom as well is it opens up debate around what a variable typeface should be. So I think at the moment, inherently, because it's in its second wave infancy, there's an exaggeration of what the possibilities are. So, you know, like the wind typeface, it's very, very display oriented. The wind is coming from this direction and it's a very gestural kind of out there typeface. Or if they are, you know, using more traditional sans serif faces that are used for setting larger bits of text, the poles in which you can vary it are extreme, because it's like, hey, it's new and you can do this, that, and the other. Whereas I think questioning how much variance you give is really, really interesting, and where you give variance and why still allows a type designer to have intent with what they were trying to create with those forms, but also allow more flexibility within a broader context of things, rather than going like, well, here's one typeface that can be extended, condensed, up, down, italics at any angle, as well as fat and skinny, is kind of probably too far. But here is a typeface that is intended to be set for this thing, and it can vary within this to this for these parameters. I think it can be inherently interesting. And that font gauntlet, I think, will work as a tool to crack that dialogue happening a little bit more, which will then inherently allow for the evolution of it to happen quicker, to allow the commercial and practical applications of it to be realized sooner, rather than it be this pipe dream for quite a while.
Yeah, and for the things to settle beyond the initial excitement. And I think just one thing in reading about variable fonts, to me, it really points out how much being a type designer is entwined with being like a coder or a programmer. Like I had the same realization when I first started working with Dave Foster, one of our artists and a world-renowned type designer, and also with Vincent Chan, who I know that you are currently working with.
Vincent Chan's doing a typeface for us.
Amazing, very talented type
boy crush right now. Man crush, sorry. Sorry, Vincent.
Well, I've collaborated with him on a number of projects and he's incredible. And of course, there's obviously, I think it's such an interesting area because there's a huge level of artistry and creativity in that traditional sense. But it's also like really tech heavy. And in particular with creating something like a variable font, I imagine there's such an intense and necessary blending of artistic skills with technical competency, which is, I'm trying to think of other areas of work that really have that same intensity on both planes.
Yep.
It's fascinating. The other thing I do want to know is that that interview, Dynamo talked about how on the web, all the information that's packed in a variable font can be controlled by anything from the sort of position of your cursor to the weather in the Bahamas, or even the inflation curve of a foreign currency. And this is when you talk about this sort of like dynamic, responsive sort of space for it to sit in, but how a digital project using sort of variable fonts can be responsive and interactive in that sense is really interesting, how the design can sort of be a direct and flexible mirror of its underlying and changing content. I think that's pretty exciting to think about the potential applications of that.
Yeah. Not only controlling the poles of where it varies, but what is the input that makes it vary mm-hmm. that is contextually relevant to what you're trying to communicate.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, there's some really rich visual content in this article. Well, we're going to post a link to it, obviously, and also kind of put it in some of our enhanced content. But otherwise, I think we'll probably put variable type into the pot with VR and AR and to see what emerges, as well as the most experimental tech to give us some commercial results. But Reese, thanks for bringing this to the show, and we'll move on from there. It is time for the very hot, very, very hot thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, bad, and the completely groovy off of our chest. Lara, what do you got for us, apart from a thumbs down for sitting in this hot room?
I'm actually finally, I know I said it before, but I'm now finally starting to regulate right as we're about to wrap up. But anyway, I can't wait to get out of here. No, I've got a thumbs down this week. My thumbs down is to real estate agents. It's been 5 weeks since my dishwasher broke. And the only thing they've done since then was on the same day, they sent 3 different plumbers just to find the serial number, like at different times in the day. They sort of didn't communicate properly. And they accidentally sent 3 different plumbers on the same day to find the serial number of the dishwasher. It's been 5 weeks. It's still not fixed. I hate real estate agents.
Cool.
You own a property. You are.
That's right.
Reese, what about you?
I've got a thumbs up. A friend of mine introduced me to the wonders of homemade pasta, which on two ends of the scale is amazing. Mm-hmm. One, flavor and taste. Mm-hmm. The other, it's a pain in the ass to make. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, you don't have pasta every second night of the week.
Uh-huh.
So then the waistline, benefit. You know?
I still have pasta every second night of the week. I just go back and forth between homemade and...
Yeah. Wow, you're that committed.
What pasta did you make?
I've only got like 2 of the attachments on the end. So there's like the little skinny ones and then the...
I recommend, just saying, if you want pasta that's incredibly easy, not a pain in the ass, but also like mind-blowingly delicious, ricotta gnocchi. Takes like 20 minutes to whip up. It's so simple and so damn good.
I just feel like, you know, making pasta is like such an investment in stuff. You need the tree as well, like the little tree that you hang
not
the pasta on.
Not with ricotta gnocchi, man.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll report back.
I promise you, you will not regret it. Jeremy.
I will round out with a shocker this week. Now, this is a hot tip for everyone on earplugs, basically. So
what we've all been waiting for.
Yeah, I know you have been. I'm a big fan of The Wire Cutter, which is kind of now owned by the New York Times blog that kind of recommends kind of best things. And like, they don't have one for earplugs, at least as far as I'm concerned. So I'm going to do a public service and actually recommend the best earplugs. And now I did this kind of scientifically. I went to the worst named Australian website called earjobs.com. Yeah, I know. Exactly. Terrible. They're a phenomenal purveyor of earplugs, though. And I ordered every set that they had out, the samples of every set, and kind of worn them for a month because, kids, it's a whole thing. And the problem is I, like you, Laura, have very sensitive ear canals.
Yes.
And I needed to find kind of the right one. So I'm happy to report
something
here.
Something we've bonded over.
Something we have. I'm happy to report here that Heroes, I didn't even realize it was a pun until now, but Heroes. They are the winner from my shootout of the best earplugs. They're amazing. They don't hurt at all. And I've tried all of them and all of them hurt. I've even had custom earplugs made by an audiologist and those hurt. So yeah, if you're looking for a good earplug, you heard it here first. And if you use the coupon code, no, there's no coupon code. If you actually want to get a pair and do it, let me know. So
I have 2 things to say, Jeremy.
Yes.
One, if anyone asks me, whenever people ask me like, what's Jeremy like? I'm going to tell that story of you buying every, because that to me is like the perfect encapsulation of
diligent
as a human. And 2, you blew my mind when we were away working and you gave me earplugs because we were doing works on the house. It was really, and I'm just an earplug rookie. And I put them in. I was like, Jeremy, they're not even blocking any sound. And you're like, yeah, you have to twist them and then put them in and then let it. And I had no idea. I've been using earplugs wrong my whole life. I was like, these don't work. People are dumb. Turns out I was dumb.
It's a difference between you and a creative director like me. We know how to insert your plugs.
Don't repeat my annual review just yet, Jeremy.
Reese, if people want to find more about you and the studio, where can they not or maybe find you on social media?
They can find the studio at TCYK Design on Instagram and Facebook. And they can find us at tcyk.com.au.
And they can find you personally, maybe wandering around Collingwood the streets.
Probably somewhere between Otter Street, Bedford Street, and
just yell Reese really loudly and see if anyone responds.
Thanks so much for coming on, Reese.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Wartzman, she's Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. you can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and the links we cover can be found at JackieWinter.givesyouthe.biz. And if you want to receive all the links we talk about in the show in one neat little package, sign up to our newly redesigned newsletter at JWG.is/newslettering. Again, that is JWG.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@JackieWinter.com. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, or Apple Podcast, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them, as well as other visual content. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. We are getting the fuck out of this hot room.
Thank
bye,
God.
Bye. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Bryce. Oh, you see? I fucked it up. I said Bryce.
I'm in your head.
In my head. You even said that the rice inside me. I was thinking of rice milk and almond milk and everything. And I knew I was going to fuck it up. This is why I should never ask people how to pronounce their surname.
You just got to wing it, Jeremy.
Because I fuck it up. It's like that thing where you get to the top of a building and, you know, you're just like, am I going to jump? No, not going to jump.